Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisko.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, an enormous monstrous mother. And there's a lot of monstrous mothers of late. I just feeling, as a mom, feeling it.
It is funny. You don't... first and foremost, let me introduce our guest. Jill it's Krajewski. I hope that I didn't fuck that up.
It's Krajewski. So close.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. freelance writer for Vulture, New York Magazine, Spin, Pitchfork, and perhaps most importantly, fellow Torontonian, is here to talk with us today about, don't give that look,
you'll
Emily.
Listen.
You know what?
Listen.
It's rare that I get to do that.
I never have gotten to say a fellow South Dakotan. That is not a thing that has ever happened.
Yeah, I was gonna
wait a minute. My wife is one, so we'll have her on. I'll describe her as that. I'll be like, that's the most important thing. Fellow South Dakotan.
It is most important to me in this moment. What I was going to say, to piggyback on what you were saying, Emily, you very... because there's a lot of male filmmakers that are all dealing with mommy issues. I'm assuming that's why we have mothers that are monsters as opposed to fathers that are monsters. We don't see a lot of father monsters.
You know what? If we do, they tend to be like human size. They tend to be like the stepfather, Terry O'Quinn. Yes. They tend to be like just bad, abusive dads.
Bad dude.
It's just like, I had an abusive dad and I'm just going to make you look at him for a while. Whereas all the mother movies are like, what if my mom could put me back inside of her?
So we're talking about Brain Dead / Dead Alive. I figure we should just call it Brain Dead since that's, you know, it's home country. But Jill, I reached out to you. This was one of your first picks, and I kind of want to know your history with it. When did you see it? Clearly this is, as you mentioned, one of your favorite horror films, but what's your history with the movie?
Absolutely. I first saw Brain Dead at the impressionable age of 17. I was in my first year of university, as we say in Canada, the first year of university. And I wasn't even taking film, but college is just such a nascent time of, this isn't part of your worldview yet. This cultural totem to me is not part of your, you're not quoting it every day yet. Oh, let me show you the way. And so my dear friend in university, Steve Huffman, said, my film 101 class, we're watching Brain Dead tonight. You have to come with me. And so I just like super keener went along to film 101, even though I wasn't taking it. And it was just like this zombie comedy mecca at a time very ripe for zombie movies like Shaun of the Dead, sure. The Walking Dead TV series, and graphic novel. It just struck such a chord with me. I was just hooting and hollering over all of this impeccably crafted gore and Foley artistry. I mean, I hope this movie is as heralded not just by horror fanatics, but in practical effects, because holy shit. At seeing this movie at 17, earlier on in the pandemic, when everyone was once again in that, oh my God, you have to see this movie to forget about the world, this movie, I took it upon myself to be the Steve Huffman to a group of friends over Zoom. And I was like, it's Peter Jackson, you know, Lord of the Rings, like kind of like willfully misleading them.
Yeah, you lied.
Yeah, you lied. Yeah. You just
just like the lie. Mom lied.
I mean, the thing about that kind of hit me about this movie is that I was a little, I know that there is a large fan base for this film. It has a sort of diehard cult status. At the same time, you know, we did Army of Darkness a few weeks ago, and obviously there is this kind of Evil Dead vibe to it. I mean, just sort of that the manic camera angles. I mean, I think this entire film is shot with a wide angle lens. It's interesting that Evil Dead, which is obviously a few years previous, has sort of more love, I would say, to some degree than this film. But they're both such big filmmakers. They both sort of are playing in the same sandbox. This film just doesn't seem to get the same amount of talk that the Evil Dead movies get. I'm sort of curious as to why you think that is.
That also struck me when I was rewatching Brain Dead. I went on an Evil Dead tear earlier on in the summer and caught up on everything except for Evil Dead Rises. I still need to see it, but it struck me that, oh, Sam Raimi, like my introduction to him was, of course, like the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies. And then for Peter Jackson to come to the fore internationally for the Lord of the Rings adaptation, and now he's done the remastered Beatles documentary, Get Back. It's hysterical that each of these Hollywood directors got started in very gory, scrappy horror. But also, I've had this conversation a lot recently, like about the rise of horror recently, or the renaissance, or at least this like very fertile creative period for horror right now. And a lot of it comes from, if your idea is so good, if your script is so tight, you don't need that huge cast, huge budget to really have word of mouth. For Evil Dead, I think it definitely benefited through the staying power of Bruce Campbell as just becoming a cult icon in and unto himself. Whereas the talent in Brain Dead, they just haven't had that quippy, one-linery sort of etching.
And it didn't create a franchise is kind of the thing, too, I imagine, to some degree. I mean, the Evil Dead movies, their success is, you know, kind of all over the place. The first one, obviously, very small. The second one, a huge cult classic, Army of Darkness, as we talked about, was not a gigantic success. It was successful enough. And then obviously, you know, you've had these two kind of reboot revivals. Brain Dead was kind of a one-off thing, understandably, because I don't ultimately know how you go back into this world necessarily. But, this was the first time that I had seen this. It's also the only one of this early Peter Jackson kind of trilogy of horror films that I've seen of his. I haven't seen Meet the Feebles. I was introduced to him probably with The Frighteners, is my guess. I think
makes sense. Yeah. Did you not watch Heavenly Creatures?
I saw that after I saw Frighteners.
Weirdly, I saw that on video because for some reason I was very drawn to a story of two teenage girls who had murderous.
Crazy. But I love the Lord of the Rings films. They're kind of in a thing all to themselves to a certain degree. It's hard to sort of separate what movie of the six, you know, I probably lean towards Fellowship, but I think that Heavenly
it's
Creatures
it's maybe probably The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smog. I've heard you talk about that so many times.
Benny the Dragon, yeah.
Oh, I hated the Hobbit movie. I read the book when I was 11 and I was like, where's the humor? Yeah, like yeah. These like ogres in the forest are supposed to be goofy. Why are they supposed to be like prestige, like CGI? No, these are it was supposed to be a children's book, and it just got way too serious.
It should have been adapted like the BBC Chronicles of Narnia series. It should have just been like puppets and shit. And like if Guillermo del Toro had done it, I imagine there would have been some of that. It still would have been bloated because they were going to make two films. And I get it. The book is full of incident, but like not like plot. So like you kind of have to adapt all the daring escapes or whatever. I kind of like the first one, and just because it's like an hour and a half of people sitting around eating and singing, and it's like Cougar Town in Middle Earth, and then they go on an adventure. I'm like, why are you leaving?
I never saw the third one, quite honestly. I saw the first two, and then I was like, I think I'm good.
You gotta see the third one, Phil.
Do
what if it turns you all around on it? No, it's the worst of them. Although I wrote at Vox at the time that it was the best of them, and that's why I got fired from Vox.
Oh God. You're on the wrong side of history.
I do think that Peter Jackson is kind of one of those guys, though, that, you know, in that kind of James Cameron-y way of like, he kind of can do whatever the fuck he wants at this point, and he's decided that he wants to just remaster old Beatles documentaries for which is great. I mean, I thought Get Back was wonderful, but
have you seen his World War One doc? It's so good.
It's fantastic. I doubled back once I lured my parents to watch Get Back over the holidays with me. I was like, hey, you like war stuff, right? How about remastered war stuff? And it was stunning. The level of technology available now. Oh my God. Like just think of how much the mother's womb sequence could be done now in HD.
Perfect. I think that like he got so burnt out on making those Hobbit movies. If you watch the special features, he was just like, I'm going to chill and make documentaries. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to skip ahead to my point from the end of this podcast, evidently. Nice. I think he needs to make a thing like this again. I don't know how possible it is. You know, Sam Raimi could go back and do Drag Me to Hell, but it's very hard for a director to get back in the mode they were in as a young guy or a young woman. And it's, yeah, there is a thing with Peter Jackson where every time he tries to do something like his early career, he just overloads effects on it. I think because like Weta is partially dependent on him. So
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, I think that he absolutely got burned out on the Hobbit films, and they're also not particularly beloved. Like people were not happy with the way that they turned out. But I would argue that I actually think Lovely Bones was a real breaking point for him. A movie that when he announced it, I was like, oh great, this is like Heavenly Creatures. Like we're gonna go back to that sort of grief and that movie is a disaster.
I think it was a breaking point for audiences who were already kind of like on King Kong. Sure. I love King Kong.
I like it too.
Great. But like, I think audiences were a little, why is this a 3-hour movie about a giant monkey? I am not Peter Jackson and don't care that much. I think The Lovely Bones, he's Stephen McKinley Henderson in Lady Bird. He's just like, they didn't understand it. I think he has affection for that movie. I think he does not care about the Hobbit movies at all.
I mean, The Lovely Bones, we did an episode, Kenny and I, for our 2009 Patreon podcast on it. And it was one of those things that we were all kind of in dismay that all these things had kind of gone wrong with this, a book that was really beloved. I never read the book. I don't know if you guys ever read Lovely Bones.
Can't say I have.
Yeah, it's good.
Did you like it, Jill?
It's fine.
Oh no, I cannot say I have. Apparently, I'm not into Bones. Sorry to Emily Deschanel.
Have you seen the movie The Lovely Bones, or have you not seen the movie either? You're fine. You don't need to see it. I mean, point is, ultimately, I think that it's really kind of, after the enormous success of Lord of the Rings, he kind of has two blank checks to kind of do whatever he wants, right? And he decides that he's going to go all in on King Kong, his favorite film as a child, which is a great movie. The original's great. I like his remake. And then he decides that he's going to try to do, I guess, an Oscar-friendly sort of thing. And it's just an absolute disaster on so many levels. But Saoirse Ronan, great as always. But yeah,
I think that movie comes so close to working, too. Like, it's not even like when you're watching it, it's disastrous. And then when you think about it for 5 minutes afterward, you're like, oh, that could have worked with this and this tweaked.
Right.
If Ryan Gosling, if he had stuck around, you know. And if they had not, if they had made the afterlife slightly more abstractionist,
or just you, or you quite would frankly have been cooking just tactile.
Yeah.
Yeah. It turns into, did you ever see What Dreams May Come? You ever see that fucking Robin Williams afterlife movie? It felt very similar to that. But all that being said,
I love it. I loved it at the time. I haven't revisited it.
But with Brain Dead, and you go back to sort of this tactility and this practical effects and this like $3 million budget, and you're just sort of like, there's this, it's so vibrant and it's so filled with, same with Heavenly Creatures, which comes after this film, in terms of like all of those effects are also stop motion and claymation, and it all just feels like, you know, it exists in their world. And I think that's so important.
And you know what? That honestly draws out a better visceral reaction as a viewer. And then performances among the actors. I'm a big fan of Corridor Crew. They're a VFX collective, and they do this great VFX Artist React series on YouTube. And time again, whenever they've broken down that a great scene is done by reacting to something in the real world versus, say, their Jurassic Park reboot with Chris Pratt, where they're just reacting to like, oh, look at that ball. Oh, no. It's, you see it in the performances, and it makes for worse off movies. So I am pro practical effects all the way, miniatures, pro miniatures. Like, I don't want to see a blue screen on my movies. I just want to see what's real, as you were speaking to, what's visceral.
I think what's fascinating, not to keep harping on his career, but what's fascinating is that tactility exists in the Lord of the Rings movies, and it exists in Kong, and then he just stops being able to do it very abruptly, seemingly. Like in Kong, you do feel like you could reach, and I think that maybe because Serkis was on sets, they were playing off of him. But yeah, it's weird.
I think there's also something to be said as well for, you know, there's a limitlessness to computer generated effects, which I imagine is very enticing, right? Which is, I can have anything I want, whenever I want. I can change it. I can delete. You know what I mean? Like, it's just there is a flexibility to it that I think, on top of it being cheaper, that I think filmmakers are drawn to. But I think that ultimately what's great about these practical effects too is you're forced into it, right? Like, it is putting a kind of a gun to your head and saying like, this is the way it has to be. And I think that, you know, you have to just fully commit to it in a way that I don't think you do with special effects, with visual effects.
It can be messy. And you know what? Real life zombies are messy. It's important for accurate zombie representation in film.
I totally agree. Yeah, for sure. I'm going to give a little bit of context for our listeners who might not have seen this film. Overprotected mother Vera Cosgrove, played by Elizabeth Moody, spying on her grown son Lionel, played by Timothy Baum, as he visits the zoo with his lovely Paquita, played by Diane Penalver, is accidentally bitten by...
I believe it's Penalve.
My apologies. Thank you.
That's just my assumption from knowing many years of Spanish class.
Is accidentally bitten by the fearsome Sumatra rat monkey. When the bite turns his beloved mother into a zombie, Lionel tries to keep her locked safe in the basement, but her repeated escapes turn most of the neighbors into the walking dead, who then crash a high society party is a little bit, but anyway, thrown by Lionel's boorish uncle Les. Braindead opened in Australia and New Zealand on August 13th, 1992, and in North America under the title Dead Alive in February of 93. It would go on to make $242,000 on a $3 million budget. It has 89% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 86% from audiences. Variety gave the film a positive review, saying Jackson's best film to date. Kiwi gore specialist Peter Jackson, who goes for broke with an orgy of bad taste and splatter humor. Some will recoil from the gore, but Braindead wasn't meant for them. And then Braindead placed number 91 on a top 100 list produced by Time Out magazine after conducting a poll with several authors, directors, actors, and critics who worked within the horror genre. I think that this movie...
Number one for what? Number one for what?
Oh, it's a list of horror films, I believe, of all time.
Oh, okay. All right. I liked this movie, but come on.
I mean, 91... I mean,
oh, I thought you said number. I heard number
91.
One.
Okay. No.
91
is
fine.
Yeah. In that case, 90, I don't know. For me, it could creep up.
It might be higher. Yeah, I agree. I think it's higher than 91.
A sliding scale. Like, No.
I think if they did that today, who knows? I mean, Emily, I know you're a big horror person. I am not. And I know that I lean more towards this type of horror film because it allows me to have fun and not actually be scared. But how does this rate for you? I don't need you to rate it in terms of horror of all time, but like, where does this fall for you in terms of the horror genre?
Funnily enough, I think it's the 91st best horror film of all time. No, I like this movie. I like the Evil Dead movies. The only one of them I truly love is Evil Dead 2, like in this style.
Sure.
There's something about it that I find exhausting. Like, it is throwing things at you so much. And honestly, after weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of me complaining about movies that do not remind me of, you know, my life and where I grew up, this movie reminded me so much. Like, when you said, you were like, I don't know if that's a list. That is a high society party, my friend. That is how.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a cool, chill party with the like, like patriarchs and matriarchs of the town or whatever.
Sure.
And
sure.
It's yeah, I liked this movie a lot while also being like, at the hour mark, I was like, how much of this do I have left? And I was like, a half hour more. And yeah, I can't
but,
even.
But I would
entirely
argue the best half hour.
Oh, sure. Like, I was never not entertained. I was just like, there's no tonal variance in a movie like this.
Right.
And that kind of just eventually bounces me off of it a little bit. I also didn't like Mad Max Fury Road that much the first time I saw it. I had to see it like three, four times because I really struggle with just like constant things happening. And now that's one of my favorite movies ever. So
I do think, for what it's worth, you also named another Australian filmmaker or from the region of that of the planet. I do think that, you know, we talked Baz Luhrmann on our Strictly Ballroom episode, and I think that, you know, those the Australian films that tend to travel over here and make it over here tend to be the noisiest, you know what I mean, the ones that are the most kind of chaotic or manic. So I totally hear you that like that can, I personally enjoy it, but I agree with you that like they can overstay their welcome. I would argue that the three films we're talking about in terms of Strictly Ballroom, this film and even Fury Road are all relatively short. So like they don't overstay their welcome.
What's so fascinating about New Zealand film is that Peter Jackson's like the guy who does this. And you got like Jane Campion and Lee Tomohori and Nikki Caro, who are all very different, like contemplative, much like they are making movies that feel in touch with rural cinema from other parts of the world. So like that's a like interesting wrinkle here is that Peter Jackson is just like bonkers, but kind of sui generis bonkers.
What were you going to say, Joe?
Oh, I was going to say anything but Baz Luhrmann's Australia. That is the one thing I will never touch again. The one plane movie I actually turned off in the plane because it was too much.
Oh, so you're not a Baz fan?
I am a Baz fan. This is the thing. Like, of course, like doing musical theater, I ate up Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge. But Australia was just like the bloated passion project haunts every prestige director.
Doesn't it, though? Like, it is interesting how, I mean, that film also, we talked about this, touched on this a little bit in our Strictly Ballroom episode, but, you know, he almost did a Alexander the Great film with Nicole Kidman and Leonardo DiCaprio. And then Oliver Stone beat him to the punch, essentially, and got his to the screen faster. And thus we got Australia instead, which, I mean, is just unfortunate because his Alexander the Great movie would be interesting, if nothing else. But
are you excited for 6 hours of Australia, Jill? He's just Baz is like the problem.
Yeah, Hulu's
with this,
giving us
the problem with this movie is there's not enough of it, and he's just like hitting the throttle. He's just like, we're gonna
he Baz too hard. He Baz too close to the sun.
What if that fixes it? What if 6 hours is the right length for Australia?
It's
like
I
a
hope
mini
so.
Series, maybe.
Yeah. It is interesting though, because I do feel like. Speaking of sort of very successful filmmakers that get opportunities to sort of make the big thing, I mean, Peter Jackson obviously I mean, I would argue I like Return of the King. It's certainly my least favorite of the three. It's the one that feels like it has 15 endings. It feels bloated.
And
the
extent, as we know, I genuinely last year I rewatched all three of them. I would say Return of the King is still my least favorite, but it moved so much up in my estimation. Now I think it earns all those endings. So
I watched the extended cuts during the pandemic and was blown away by the extended cuts of all of them. And I would argue might be the only time I can point to extended cuts being better than the theatrical cuts.
You should do an extended cut of Brain Dead. He should just be like, here's yes. all the stuff we left on the cutting room. But he'd have to finish with CGI, and that would be a problem. So yes,
there's true. So much cutting to be left on the cutting room floor.
I've been thinking about this question of like, yes. why these movies haven't held up and not held up, but haven't been remembered in the same way as the Evil Dead movies. And I do think the lack of Bruce Campbell and New Zealand aspects are huge hindrances, but I also think they don't feel like they come from the guy who made Lord of the Rings. Now, obviously if you watch Lord of the Rings with these in mind, you see all the ways it influenced it. Lord of the Rings has a sincerity and an earnestness to it that the Spider-Man movies don't lack, but that like the Spider-Man movies tone down just enough that you can mm-hmm. be like, yes, Sam Raimi. And also Sam Raimi puts in some really like hardcore horror type sequences as much as he can get away with in a PG-13 in those movies. So Evil Dead feels like it was made by the same guy. And this kind of feels like it was made by a guy who just like had a personality transplant in 1999. And I like when you watch it as like watching the arc of his career, it makes a lot more sense. But if you watch Lord of the Rings and that's your introduction to Peter Jackson, and then you come back and watch this, you're like, yeah. they don't feel like the same guy.
If anything, I think that the closest we've seen to a revival of interest in Brain Dead came from the late 2000s. That's when I first caught wind of it. You had not only Peter Jackson's name and status ballooning, rightfully so, after Lord of the Rings, but also there's this resurgence in the 2000s of zombie lore. Like, you had World War Z or Z appear. You had, of course, all of these zombie hallmarks coming to the fore, such as The Walking Dead. I mentioned Shaun of the Dead. You had, for any gamers, Call of Duty's Nazi zombies sequence was sure. very big. So there was this resurgence of interest in zombies.
And The Last of Us as well. I mean,
absolutely. That game absolutely. Was huge. Yeah, even just before The Last of Us, it definitely is part of that revival. And my question to all of you would be, why did zombies come back? I mean, that seems to be in their nature, but there was this particular fixation in the 2000s where something like Brain Dead, the word of mouth traveled, sure. not just because of Peter Jackson's stature, but
you also had 28 Days Later, which felt like it kind of yes. opened up that genre again a little bit. I mean, Emily, do you have thoughts?
If you look at when Brain Dead came out in the 90s, there's just not a lot of zombie stuff happening. Sure. And honestly, a lot of the other zombie stuff is tonally similar to this. Like, what's the goofiest thing we can get away with? You know, can we put a baby in a blender and then the blender turns so fast that it sends the baby skyrocketing yeah. into the sky? I haven't tried that with my baby, but I doubt it would work. And I'm not going to try it because I like yeah. my baby. Like,
not a zombie baby.
It's not a zombie. It's not a zombie baby. I mean, there's this hacky thing that often turns out to be true, which is when Republicans are in charge, vampires are popular, and when Democrats are in charge, zombies are popular. And because zombie films vampire films, not always, but tend to be about a collective gathering to take on the singular, like example of a rich person who needs to have a stake driven through their heart. And zombie films tend to be about individuals or small communities taking on just enormous hordes of sure. monsters. And there is a political code to both of those stories, which we might find not particularly flattering, but that's what horror is for, is unpacking the things that are unflattering in our subconsciouses. I don't know if that is completely true. I think it's implying causation where there's correlation, but I do think that there was a thing in the late 2000s where it sort of felt like there were just endless amounts of problems, and zombies could stand in for any number of them. They stand in for climate change really well. They stand in for, you know, terrorism really well. They say, yeah, if you are like concerned about if you are a racist, zombies stand in. Zombies are just a great all-purpose metaphor in a way that vampires, werewolves, ghosts, etc. often are not. Those tend to be, because they've been around so long, those tend to have like a pretty hard and fast correlation in a way that zombies, which are not new, but like our conception of them is pretty new, is pretty post-George Romero, in a way they're a little bit more malleable.
Really well said. And there's an intimacy to the zombie as a creature that's very flexible. It makes terror that much closer to home. It could be your own abusive mother. It could be your nurse, the trusty priest, as we've seen, the trusty kick-ass priest.
No, it is interesting as well that I feel like there's something like biological to the zombie thing that's slightly different than these other manifestations, that it, you know, it is kind of a virus, you know what I mean? It less so than, you know, vampirism or where, I mean, I guess it's all kind of bite oriented, but I do think that there's something about this person you love potentially turning into a mindless brain eating machine, as opposed to there's still a personality that exists with a werewolf when they're in their human form or a vampire. This, they become this sort of dead eyed thing, which I think is also part of it
too. There's a tragedy, especially to werewolves and ghosts. And sometimes to vampires. Vampires are their own thing.
We
talked about Bram Stoker's Dracula already.
We did.
There's to zombies, the tragedy is like the tragedy recedes. It's a Doppler shift. When the person dies and they get bitten, that's a tragic moment. And then when they turn, that tragic moment just gets further and like it's further in the past. You stop thinking about it and you're just like, I just need to kill this person. My friend Matt Zoller-Seitz, the great critic, sure. I think he wrote this about Walking Dead, is like there is an element to the zombie genre that is like, I want to see a bunch of humans get killed in disgusting fashion and still like have it be acceptable. Yeah. You know, there is the appeal of the snuff film to the zombie film. And like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that zombie films are, again, a healthy way to process this part of our subconscious. Sure. But it is present constantly.
Yeah, there's also something. Zombies are like a horde. Do you know what I mean? Like, you generally speaking in these horror films, when it comes to vampires or werewolves or even ghosts, it's not the same. Like, it's a horde of people. It's a mass of people, which I think is also fun to watch. You know what I mean? When you think about the end of this film and you literally see him using a lawnmower to mow down, you know, dozens and dozens of people, there is... It's just different. I think that with these vampire films and werewolf films, they tend to focus on the Wolfman or Dracula or the Mummy, right? Like it's a singular entity of sorts. Whereas this is very different. I mean, I liked World War Z fine, but again, you know, to go back to CG and what have you, but like those, the waves of people and the way that they moved in that film was pretty scary. I mean, the idea of hundreds and hundreds of anything coming at you is pretty intimidating.
The other element to zombies that's fascinating is the heroes in these movies, if there is any semblance of humanity having hope, they're also fairly ordinary. So you have these ordinary, like, I always love the 10,000 foot view of a horror, whether it's grief, such as in The Babadook or Hereditary or here, where someone's escaping an abusive relationship with their overbearing mom. Overbearing would be putting it kindly. And to have Lionel prevail, like the heart of the story is so much more than the scary and gushy, quite gushy evil. And that might be why the zombie movie also has staying power, because the monsters are ordinary, but so are the potential heroes. Sure, and that's very inspiring in a way. Oh.
What's fascinating to me is that pre-Romero zombie movies tend to be singular. It tends to be like a person who's brought back from the dead. and kind of stumbles around, and it's someone you knew and you're scared of them. And so I was like, when you were saying that, Phil, I was like, what's a singular zombie movie? And Jill, I'd love you to weigh in on this. And I was like getting excited by the creative prospects of that. And I realized It Follows is a zombie movie. And it's like a single zombie that just takes many forms, which is a really smart way around that problem, and is actually very, I found that movie very frightening and scary, which is hard for me. But Jill, I'm wondering if you can think of other singular zombie movies post Romero.
Oh man, that might be tough for me to scratch. It Follows, that's really smart to think of it as a zombie movie. For me, the 10,000 foot view is like the STI panic and, oh, you have to pass it on mm-hmm. to someone. But I totally hear your argument as well. Singular zombie movies, it's hard for me to pick one out. I mean, so often it starts with all you need is just one.
Yeah.
I mean, does The Ring count?
That's more of a ghost story, I think.
Is she a ghost? I guess she's a ghost, right?
A lot of J horror is ghosts, but it's a different sort of a different sense of ghosts than we have in an American perspective. Yeah. But yeah,
I mean, I think that the first two Evil Deads are pretty singular focused mm-hmm. for the most part, being sort of the cabin in the woods thing and keeping it relatively small. I mean, it's a small group of people, but I know what you're saying, which is that, you know, I think ultimately the thing that I think is so powerful about all of these characters, if it's zombies, werewolves or vampires, is the human that's inside, right? It's this us desperately trying to either save the person that's inside or whatever it is. And it's that kind of push and pull where I think what's interesting is that with zombies, the person essentially evaporates almost immediately, right? Like they which I think is the tragedy of these situations, is that the mother's character in this film, Vera, once she turns, or I guess once she dies, hard to say. I'm not really sure.
But I feel like she turned long ago in the world of the living.
I mean, touche. I think that, I mean, for me anyway, it's sort of the turning point is when she starts to really decompose, right? When she has those high society people over for some meal of some sort, for dinner or whatever, and her skin is peeling off, and it's and she's clearly starting to lose her faculties and her functions and what have you. That's kind of the moment, I think, because then she dies shortly thereafter and obviously resurrects. But the Vera character is kind of fascinating to me in this, in the sense that she starts from a place of kind of sublimating her son and I guess not wanting him to be happy, and certainly not wanting him to be with Paquita, which I really don't know why. I mean, is this a class distinction? Is there something going on there? Is there something in terms of the race?
I think there's a racist element to it. She's Romani, and this film has some interesting depictions of the Romani. Like this film is very tapped into the racist nature of the tropes it's depicting, and is still sure. Like, well, we know what we're doing, so we sure. can like lean into that. And that's only really in the first 15 minutes. So it's, you know, it's easy to get past it, but it is present. It is a thing that like hangs over the rest of the movie. But yeah, I do think it's a race and class thing. You know, she's not the good, perfect white New Zealand girl that Vera would have him marry. Phil, have you seen Bo is Afraid?
Oh gosh, I haven't. I'm still stealing myself, but not yet.
You should see. It's not scary. Genuinely, like there are moments in it that are horror adjacent, but it is just a wild time. I think I genuinely think you would get something out of it. I don't know if you would like it, but I think you would be like, well, I did that.
I did very much love Midsommar, so I do trust Ari Aster to a degree. Let's see.
I have not seen any of Ari's films yet. And I know, Emily, that you're a big Midsommar fan, which I fully intend on watching one of these days.
I think you could watch Hereditary is the one where I'd be like, Phil, no, never do it. Absolutely never do it.
Midsommar is very palatable, and it also follows kind of like classic horror movie pacing, in the sense that it's like the first act and part of the second act are the build. And Braindead very much does the same thing, where you don't get like ahead in a washing machine, like right in the first 20. Like you're, it's all of this table setting. And that's what makes these like slight distinctions that, oh, something's a bit off now. It's just such a satisfying delayed gratification. Midsummer very much had that, just so much laying the scene. And then, oh, helped question mark, where have all my friends gone? Like it just made that so much more satisfying rather than if it just started with one of the friends' murders.
Also, it's a classic trans text, as we all know. It's just I wrote an article about this, Phil.
I didn't know that that was a take.
You need to read everything I write, Phil. I can't believe you don't. Another thing that Ari Aster and Peter Jackson have in common is they're both very funny. And all of Ari Aster's films are hilarious. You know, they have really big, like, scary moments in them, but they're so funny. Same here. And I think if I'm thinking back to our question about why this seemed to spike in the late 2000s, it's because that's when horror is at its grimmest. That's when horror is so influenced by the policies of the George W. Bush administration, by torture, by this sort of sublimation within the American psyche. This is American horror. Yeah.
And obviously remakes of Japanese horror for sure. Yeah. Ringu, Grudge.
The torture porn stuff. Yeah. It seems to also,
Were looking for other kinds of things. And like, obviously they found zombie movies have traditionally had a satirical streak to them. Not all of them do, but it's really baked into what Romero was doing, and Romero's kind of who everyone's riffing on. So yeah, this is a very gory zombie movie, but it's also a very deep satire on like the kinds of small towns that Peter Jackson was familiar with and that resonate heavily with like where I grew up.
Absolutely. Especially the, no pun intended, the reverence given to the church, and in particular the priest. It's almost like, of course, that's one of my favorite sequences. I kick ass in the name of the Lord. Or I kick ass for the Lord.
It is a great sequence. And it does feel reverent to a certain degree, right? Like there's sort of a playfulness. But that's only kind of that. Is that that's the only kind of religious element that exists in this, right? Because that the whatever you would call it, the medallion, the thing that he sort of uses, is there some sort of religious connotation to that?
You must have missed the scene where Jesus came back and was like, Phil, I'm the original zombie and I can kill anyone with my medallion. You missed that scene?
I did miss that scene. It looked, the medallion looked almost like the headpiece from Raiders.
I love that in this scene I made up, Jesus is addressing you for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know why. But I the only reason I asked, and I because I know that the grandmother gives him the medallion as sort of to protect him. But I couldn't, I just wasn't sure about like the actual kind of religious connotation with
it. I think it's a pretty classic trope that they're playing off, which is when you are in a situation like this, Christianity will not help you, but folk religion will. So, you know, the Romani people or this grandmother who's in touch with some older folk belief that perhaps like is better suited. Again, if there's an intimacy to zombies, there's an intimacy to folk religion that there just isn't in a massive institution like the church. On the other hand, you know, if you're in an exorcist movie, then get thee to a Catholic church immediately.
That's the one loophole.
It is interesting. What I appreciated about this film, and one of the many things that I think is fun about it, is that it's playful about all of this stuff. And as gory as it is, and it is very gory, and we will talk about the gore in terms of sort of the back half of the film in a second, but I just the movie immediately is having fun and whether or not, and I don't mean to suggest that the cultural appropriation of this tribe or whatever you want to call it at the beginning of this film is okay, but the zaniness of what's going on tonally is immediately sort of setting this sort of stage for a film that's going to be really out there.
He's riffing on the original King Kong there, you know, like
it's Skull Island.
It's Skull Island, and it's the natives of Skull Island are depicted similarly to that film. And you can tell the actors are having fun with it. Yeah. You know, like I'm not going to sit here and say this is the most evil a film has ever perpetrated. It's just, you know, it was like, I was like, interesting. PJ, what's up?
I appreciated the sort of the kind of the silliness and the zaniness of the opening. So the film opens in 57 with this zoologist and this team that essentially steal this rat monkey. in a Jill's shaking her head, just being like, it was a bad idea, guys. You should never have stolen the rat monkey.
But also just rat monkey, like to say that like rats raped a monkey or vice versa, and that's the seed of all evil. That's the Oppenheimer moment of this all, is this deep heart of darkness shit. Oh, it's just so gross and over the top right from that just origin story.
They should have dropped in just a couple frames of Cillian Murphy being like, I have touched the face of God and I should have not done so.
just a couple. I mean, the rat monkey, when we finally get to see the rat monkey in all its glory at the zoo, it's amazing. It is a stop motion or claymation or something to that effect. It doesn't even look remotely like plausible, which I think is also setting up or teeing up what is ultimately going to become our sort of big bad, for lack of a better way of putting it, which is the mom at the very end, which is this, you know, gargantuan, crazy, I guess, puppet is maybe the best way to describe it in terms of how it's actually, you know, controlled. But this rat monkey looks like something out of like a Henry Selick movie. It's amazing.
It reminded me of The Baby, honestly. Go ahead, Jill.
The Symmetron rat monkey looked like a deep fried gremlin, and I'm talking Spike gremlin. Like that thing is just a modicum of flesh on bone, the bug eyes. Oh, good eye choreography in this movie.
it's and then Vera the mother is bitten by the rat monkey, but then she kills it, just like literally stomps on its head until its eyes pop out and it's just oozing. I do think that, as much as I agree with you, Emily, in terms of that the tone of the piece of the film is pretty consistent, it does ratchet up well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like the dials are perfectly kind of turned as the film progresses so that you don't get bored. Mm-hmm. So like this being the first kill, you're just like, okay, so it sets up.
I would do that too. Like, that's the thing. I'm like, you know what? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sounds like the right plan. One of my favorite subgenres of horror, and there's not enough of it because it's very hard to do without being racist, to be clear, is, although like a lot of examples now are doing it with something, it's not quite folk horror. It's, we live in a place and there is an evil thing in this place and we can't let it get out of the place. The Ruins is maybe my favorite, the book, not the movie, is maybe my favorite example of this, where it's like this tribe that lives in the jungle of Mexico happens to be around this thing with a murderous plant that if it ever gets out of this clearing, like, Earth is doomed. So they are like the protectors of the planet in a weird way. And I love, and that's kind of what's going on here. But again, it's very hard to do because you almost have to set it in a very remote place that people don't go to, which means that you're starting to play off tropes about like tribesmen and things that. So it's very hard to do.
Artifacts and whatnot.
Yeah.
Right. A film I never saw because it sounds far too scary for me is The Descent.
Oh, yeah. Same. Yeah. That's one of my favorite movies. Same deal.
I haven't touched that one.
Every time you say a film I haven't seen because it sounds too scary for me, you could say The Descent, which unnerved me, which scared me. Or it could just be like, you know, I haven't seen Little Shop of Horrors. I think that sounds...
I own Little Shop of Horrors and I love it.
Oh my gosh. I was in Little Shop of Horrors in High School Musical. So
did you play Audrey or?
Oh, I played one of the little Miss Capitalists who are like, you've got a killer plant. I've got a killer business idea. Which is another theme in these movies. It's, oh, we've discovered untapped danger. Well, better charge a pretty penny for it.
Better make money off of it.
Let's have the rat monkey in the zoo. What could go wrong?
Yeah.
When the enormous Vera appears at the end, I did have the thought of Feed Me Seymour. So like it
does have similar. That. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's, yeah. The Descent, what I know of it, I think it's first of all, it's I'm claustrophobic. So
the monster stuff in that movie does not bother me as much as the I'm stuck in a cave tunnel. Can I get out? Can I get out? Like that's just thinking about that.
Yeah. It's awful. It's an awful, awful premise. But
this is why I don't go caving, honestly.
Who goes caving?
But then The Descent turns out to just be about some guys who live in a cave and just want to be left alone, which we can all relate to.
That's
fair. Oh, yeah. That's a relatable king.
That's true. There's a line that I really love when Lionel and Paquita go to the zoo on their date. And she says, but we are romantically entangled. There's something just very cute about...
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I don't know that the characters are necessarily aware of the sort of box that they're in or the trope that they're in, but certainly the writers and the filmmakers are, in terms of, and you sort of mentioned this earlier, Jill, of how like sweet and lovely and normal these two people are, desperately trying to navigate a unbelievably not normal situation. She's so sweet, and like the performance is so winning. They're both really charming, but like I just love how game she is. Like at a certain point she's just like, I guess we're doing this.
Yeah, Paquita's right there killing zombies with the rest of them. And I think that this benefits also the fact that one of the co-writers is a woman. Sure. I don't have her handy, but went on to...
Fran Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And Fran Walsh going on to be a producer on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings.
Is she his wife?
She's his partner. They have two kids together. I don't think they ever got married.
Amazing. But, okay. Yeah. I think it definitely helps so that you don't end up with like a Bryce Dallas Howard running in heels at, in Jurassic Park situation. Yes. Like to actually have a woman go, okay, like what could Paquita do in this situation? The fact that Paquita is not an accessory, but like a key part to like Lionel as well as herself escaping the mother in every sense of the word.
Totally.
I really, really like how she's written in terms of like her personality. I do agree with you, Emily, that there's definitely some racial yikes in terms of how the Romanis are played. But Paquita as a character herself, I thought was like really like bold, daring, like no damsel in distress at all.
Would you, and this is a question for both of you guys, as a woman, wouldn't Lionel's mommy issues be a red flag for you? Just saying.
Listen. If a boy is consumed by his mother while I'm dating him, I don't have to date him anymore. So
it's an asset.
Literally and figuratively consumed by his mother. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Jill, sorry, go ahead and answer that question if you want to.
Yeah, would zombie mom be issues be an issue for me?
I guess the bigger question is, would you date Lionel?
You know what? He's got the casting is right, where even though he's a doofus who looks like he can be overpowered by his mother, He's got those big puppy dog eyes and that blood-covered smile. Mm-hmm. When there's an inner confidence to him, I think I can fix Lionel.
There's like this sub. There's like this subgenre of "Am I the Asshole?" post on Reddit, which is a woman being like, "My husband and I moved to another country. We've gone no contact with his family. That's how I date Lionel. If we could like move to another country, no contact with his family. Yeah, he's cute. I'd do
it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the mom. I would say this. The mom is dead at the end. So, mm-hmm. you know,
all obstacles removed.
Give her take a few lives.
In terms of Vera's, I don't even know, evolution into zombiedom, that there's a shot that actually, like, I found maybe one of the most repulsive in the film, which is pulling the dog out of her mouth goes on for so long that I was just like, this is. I mean, it was unbelievable. I don't know how they did it either, quite honestly. Yeah, like practically.
She ate her dog, but not all of it.
It's so gross. it's amazing. You know, I also think, too, that like you mentioned earlier, Jill, in terms of like the humor of it. I mean, Vera getting hit by the tram and then that shot of her just being launched in the air. Like it is definitely just it's a very silly movie. It's having fun with how silly it is.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I really, if anything, I think that because I enjoy horror, but also deep down I'm a little scaredy cat. I like the ratio of horror to comedy in Brain Dead with Evil Dead 2. Of course, the first one was more straight horror, but Evil Dead 2, of course, it has those moments of humor, like Ash saying, groovy, but it's by and large terrifying. And I really love when something is so effective at what it is trying to parody or trying to satirize. And Brain Dead is also that for me, even though it's just like, oh my God, like a zombie baby running around. How absurd. The fact that it can still terrify me is marvelous. So I found that Brain Dead walks the line very well. Fuck that, it's a zombie baby.
So, I mean, Emily, you have a baby.
I do. Not an evil baby, though sometimes I wonder.
Did you, the baby stuff in this movie, first of all, somehow they make this baby funny and also terrifying. Mm-hmm. There is an extended sequence in the park with Lionel just, it is comedy gold of him just basically beating the shit out of a baby,
right?
And everybody just watching him do so. It is amazing. How did you feel as a parent watching that? Did you have any sympathy for the situation?
Listen, I think if your baby's evil, this is maybe fine.
All bets are off.
You know? I definitely like watched it and was like, huh, they're beating up a baby. I feel sort of similarly to it as the way that Spielberg always talks about the end of Close Encounters, where he was like, once I was a father, I couldn't have done that. This very much feels like it was made by somebody who hasn't had kids yet. And like, as someone who's had kids, I'm like, you're not quite getting the level of demonic a baby can be, right? Let me see. Let's tweak some things here. But then also I would be like, oh, but I love you. You're my baby. You're the best.
It is. I mean, the comedy of it is very funny. I mean, it's basically just, it's like a doll that he's just smacking around.
It's a Looney Tunes character. You know?
It's a Looney Tunes character that they shot over, if I'm not mistaken, it took them like, the movie was finished under budget. They spent 2 days shooting the park scene with the baby.
The baby alone. Oh, well, that was well worth it.
So just the park scene, and Peter Jackson to this day has said it's still one of his favorite scenes. Which I think is amazing.
One of the slapstick masterful moments within the zombie park scene is the fact that Lionel and this zombie baby, he's eyeing what appears to be the perfect idyllic mother and trying to mimic, oh, like this is what being a good mother is like, because Lionel doesn't have that reference point with Vera. So Lionel's kind of eyeballing, oh, here's your dolly, no, and it just backfires on him every step of the way.
Yeah. It's definitely, I think what's funny about it, obviously, is the physical humor, but it's also what you're saying, Joe, which is and I think maybe Emily, you can relate to this as well as a parent, which is that like there's no magic bullet. There's no perfect way to be a parent. And when you are a parent, you're desperately searching for, you know, fixes and solves for various things that, you know. And so I do think that that mirror that he's doing there is also kind of fun in and of itself, which is that it's in that whole sequence, it's kind of just a commentary on parenthood.
It does kind of capture the point where, because the first few months, the baby wakes up every 3 hours and wants to be fed, and that's fine. But the baby is easily confined. Now the baby is not as easily confined. And my understanding is it gets worse. Like that's, they gain the more rumor. Mobility yeah. as time Correct. Goes on. So it does capture that moment when your baby like suddenly can get places and you're like, oh, what the fuck do I do now? I just leave knives laying around. I can't do that anymore.
It's, I mean, the baby stuff, I think that the scariest moment with the baby is when it tears open the face.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Oh, that poor little square girl.
Yeah, the poor girl who you're just like, is she going to make it? She can't possibly make it. But, and then it just, from behind her, burrows through her face and tears her face up. It's an incredible effect. But oh,
forget
my God,
the shining. Awesome. That's the, here's Johnny.
It's fantastic. I also, so we skipped over the zombies procreating. And by that, I mean, we get to hear the zombie priest and the zombie nurse having sex. And then the zombie nurse eats the priest's lips.
Why
it's
not?
Fucked. Oh,
that's a, such a stunning scene to for the prosthetic lip to be the,
the
off
tearing lips. It's amazing.
And chewed up. We get that overhead shot of the nurse yep. chewing up her lover's lips. Oh,
it's
gosh.
So fucking gross. It's gross. Then there's a moment where Lionel thinks that he's poisoning the zombies, but he's actually giving them some sort of an animal stimulant. So then they are all like recharged. It's incredible.
Always read the terms and conditions.
Always read the fine print. Yeah, always read the fine print. The lighting of them coming out of the ground is like there's some really, really beautiful cinematography in this film. Like I know we're talking a lot about the visual effects and the special effects and all this stuff, and it all is phenomenal, but if it's lit badly, it'll all look like shit. And the photography is making so much of this thing. And I think that that should be noted. But so he injects them with this animal stimulant. Also, by the way, there's this whole sequence where he's just like essentially injecting paralysis or some sort of a knocking them out.
Tranquilizer.
A tranquilizer. Right. So he's constantly injecting his mother with tranquilizers to try to get her to, you know, not attack people. The whole scene in the morgue when she's just like oozing and exploding as they're trying to like, I guess, embalm her before this funeral.
Another great eyeball sequence where they Incredible. Have to punch her eye jelly back in.
It's like a Three Stooges thing. It's amazing. And then there's the whole sequence in the cemetery where these hoodlums are there. Obviously, this all plays. It's all part of the whole the priest beating them up, and then we're alluded to the mother bursting out of her grave and tearing off the genitals of a guy that's pissing on her grave. I mean, this shit's crazy. This movie is just absolutely insane.
I was just double checking the editor of this film worked with Peter Jackson yeah. on Lord of the Rings, won an Oscar for Lord of the Rings. I was just looking that up and I came back and you were like, and bites the genitals. And I was like, right, I'm talking about this movie.
I mean, it is really fascinating how you can see like the orcs stuff is not that far removed from the zombie stuff in this. Like there is that corollary, but I mean, obviously it doesn't even come remotely close to this crazy shit.
The Uruk Hai is especially like really on line with that.
Yeah.
This is a director with such attention to detail, even when it's for just how much green ooze is enough to come out of this mother's corpse. In this
a
moment.
Fountain.
How much can we blow up her little yeah. nightdress, her little
I mean, this, I mean, the end of this film, apparently 300 liters of blood was used. And you know, it is interesting because I do feel like blood is often not particularly believable, right? Like there's kind of this gradation of how believable do we want the blood to be. And I feel like this movie and those sort of, even like Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, which is obviously a nod to all those Hammer films, like the blood looks too, like much like paint, for lack of a better way of putting it. Like it's a little too red, it's a little too cherry. And this movie goes there too, in a great way. Like it's all part of the cartoonishness of it and the silliness of it. I think if it all looked like real blood, it would honestly be too much to stomach. Like, I don't think you could actually watch it.
Yeah. I feel like they're like Peter Jackson, if he found like an oozing pustule on his arm one morning, he would just be like, I should go to the doctor, but first I got to poke this a little bit to see what happens. Pokey pokey. Yeah, honestly, as a fellow pustule poker, like I relate. I get it.
That's your TikTok, isn't it?
The pustule poker. Yeah.
That's
I mean, even just the mother's wound when we see it for the first time after he sort of like unbandages it, and it looks ridiculous in the best way, right? Like it literally, like it's almost pulsating. It looks like it's some sort. It doesn't. None of the like. The biological components of this movie are even remotely plausible, which is part of why it's great.
It's so hysterical. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Emily.
I was just going to say it's clear Phil's never taken a biology class because all of this is very plausible.
If anything, I really appreciated the farce of all these zombies trying to eat Lionel's, trying to give them their spoonful, or
yes,
the spoon goes through the back of the gangster's head. There's the nurse who's trying to swallow and it just comes out of her slit throat, and Lionel just opens her up to dump it down. Like there's nothing here worth salvaging. And yet Lionel thinks that it'd be more cruel to put them out of their misery than to have them have zombabies in his house.
My favorite thing is the like digestive system that's just like chasing him around. That's
yeah.
So good.
It's a character that you literally, when it dies at the end and it essentially like looks at itself in the mirror, and there's just sort of this like existential thing. Like,
relatable again. Relatable AF.
It's there is so much in this film that, I mean, it was interesting too, because I feel like if you look at someone like Tim Burton, who, you know, say you put this film next to a Beetlejuice, which I guess to some degree that you know you could. Burton, who never goes even remotely close to this type of shit, right, gets tagged for being like, you know, too much. Whereas, I don't know, like I think about Sam Raimi, I think about this film. I love them all for the record, but I just think it's interesting how you get the impression that some filmmakers wish they could go as far as someone like Peter Jackson goes. It takes real courage to do this type of shit, is really kind of what I'm getting at.
I think you have to be deeply messed up on some level. And I think, you know what? I think if Steven Spielberg was like, I'm going to do the most fucked up shit you've ever seen. And then it would just be like, I don't know, a guy like stepping on like a bug. And you'd be like, Steven, well, the bug was a really big bug. And you're like,
sure.
Yeah. But yeah. Like you have to, there is a thing about, honestly, I was thinking about the Coen brothers as well. I think there's a thing where Peter Jackson and Sam Raimi and the Coen brothers are so informed by where they're from and the weird little like incestuous nature of these towns where everybody knows everybody and everybody knows everybody's dark secrets, sure, and nobody's talking about them, that informs them, that allows them to get into some really dark and twisted and violent places. And Tim Burton, of course, has the suburbia thing, which is, you know, its own animal.
Sure.
But there is that element of, you kind of have to have this really dark stuff to fuel this kind of zany terror.
No, for sure.
Absolutely. That was the bedrock. Yeah, sure. Oh, sorry.
No, please, Jill, go ahead. Sorry, didn't mean to cut off.
That is what you're getting at, Emily. That's the bedrock of my favorite of the new season of Black Mirror, Locke Henry, which is not only is it satirizing the true crime boom, but to what you were saying about if you come from a small town and you know the deep dark shit, the nasties that people aren't talking about, and yet it's deeply affecting everyone. It's very cathartic to produce this exaggerated over the top work to say, let's have all the secrets spill out. Let's have everyone who's done something bad
sure.
become bloodied, bloated, larger than life forces of evil that we can finally take down versus the people who still act like nobility when they're really not morally.
And the thing about something like Braindead is it taps into this thing where all of these people have repressed urges, particularly sexual and violence wise. What a way to say that, Emily, that they are not indulging. And so when they are given license, they go over the top. It really is like, I mean, I think about these movies. I do the queer phobia scale every week. And I was like, this movie is kind of about like the manifestation of all these things that these people aren't thinking about, aren't talking about, aren't allowing themselves to take pleasure in. And yeah, I think it's enormously effective in that regard. Like, it certainly goes over the top. I just want to shout out, because I just keep thinking of like practical effects. I just want to shout out the lady whose head lights up like a jack-o'-lantern.
It's the greatest. Oh. I fucking love that so much. I mean, I also think it's worth talking about for a second, because I think that not that it's a fine line necessarily, but you know, I couldn't help but think about fellow Torontonian David Cronenberg when I was watching this as well, which is, you know, Cronenberg's whole thing is body horror.
Now there's a pustule poker. Go ahead.
Big time pustule poker.
He loves must be on pustule Reddit. That guy's on Zit Reddit. You can't tell him that Cronenberg's not.
But yeah, I mean, there is something about, I mean, his whole thing is, this vessel we have is disgusting. Like that's essentially
same.
His mantra in all of his films. Whereas I feel like Peter Jackson is like, but look at how fun this vessel is that we have. Look at all the things it can do. And that's sort of there's a deep sort of like scientific component to Cronenberg where you're feeling, which is so unsettling. Because it feels, I mean, Dead Ringer is obviously being maybe the most obvious version of that. There's just, I don't know, both of these filmmakers and how they see the human body, I think, is fascinating. Cronenberg's version of the digestive system being a character would be so absolutely repulsive. Whereas in Peter Jackson, you're sort of like, oh, the poor guy. Like, it's just, I think it's funny.
It reminds me of the alien in Spaceballs. Hello,
yes,
my
yeah,
baby.
That does the
Hello,
dance.
My honey. All he's missing is his little hat.
It's great.
I live with cats. I live with cats. I love my cats.
I live with cats.
I'm a cat-centric individual. A cat-adjacent individual. There we go. I think if you look at how a cat is put together, how a cat evolved, mm-hmm. you're like, okay, perfect. I understand absolutely how this animal came to be this way. If you look at a human body for too long, you're just like, why the fuck do we work? Like yes. how we have all these appendages yeah. and yeah. we somehow stay upright, you yeah. know?
It's a miracle.
Yeah. And it's, a lot of this has really been underlined for me by having a baby, because the baby's born and the head is so huge, the baby can't do anything. And the yeah. like for the first 3 years of our lives, we have these just enormous heads that we just kind of waddle around with.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's I often have this thought of the fact that my brain is doing what it's doing right now so I can have this conversation with you and move appendages and think the thoughts that I'm it's all beyond comprehension. And I just think it's interesting that Jackson thinks that's kind of fun, right? Whereas Cronenberg fears it. So I think there's something interesting there. Yeah, I don't know. I think that this movie, as gross as it is, Like there's a I tagged you guys and posted that shot of the guy's skin being pulled off of his skull. And it's just awesome. Like you're just like, this is just fucking cool. And the cut is perfect of the person passing frame so that you don't like it's just it's all just really masterfully done.
There's a sense of fun to the very first Evil Dead and this being an early Peter Jackson film where you don't have your own legacy shadowing over you. You're just really in it for fun. Odds are you won't win a bunch of Oscars, become this internationally hailed director, have access to the Beatles archives. Odds are you're just going to make a really fun movie in the early 90s. So I do definitely agree with you, Emily, in wanting to see Peter Jackson go back towards this direction. But I also wonder if that aura as prestige might taint how pure and raw this is.
Do you get too rich to make a movie like this?
Yeah.
You maybe do. Like, I know this is a thing I think about a lot because I love, you know, horror, obviously. And like Lily Wachowski famously loves to make dark bloody horror and like love to make one of the famous unproduced Wachowski scripts is called Cannibal, and it's about what you'd expect it to be about. And but I'm always like, well, you know, could she go do that? Do you reach a point where you are too good at what you do and too successful and have too much money to do something like this? And again, Drag Me to Hell is the one example where Sam Raimi felt like he tapped in to what he was able to do in the past, but also brought all the know-how he'd had since then to it. Most of the time when a director tries to do something like this, it ends up feeling a little bit like your high school reunion, you know, where you're there and you like recognize yourself, but also you're just too changed to really, you know, get there.
There are very, very few filmmakers that can, I don't want to say revisit necessarily, but be able to kind of have the same. I mean, I ultimately think that one of the few that can still do it is Scorsese, crazily enough. Like, I think he can still kind of find that crazy. I mean, Wolf of Wall Street, what have you. Like, I do think that he still has that in him, that fire in his belly that I think Raimi was able to tap into. I just don't know that Jackson even has the interest. Like it seems to me as though he's just a full on dad now. Like I just don't know that he's got that, you know.
I think you know what he should do is he should find like a little cheapy horror novel and just adapt that. Like
sure.
You know, like sure. Who's the person I've been reading a lot of? But it doesn't matter. He should find a horror novel and adapt that so that he is like, you know, able to tap into someone. I find a lot of times that helps.
I also feel like there was that moment when he was supposed to do a Tintin movie. You know what I mean? Spielberg was going to do one of them and Jackson was going to do, he produced that. And then Jackson was going to do one that Spielberg was going to produce. And I don't know if it's that Tintin wasn't successful enough, even though I do think it actually did make quite a bit of money. But I only say this because I'd be interested to see Peter Jackson off the chain in a mocap situation. I think that could be fun, but you know, I don't think we're going to get that either.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead, Jill.
If anything, I'm endeared to see, even though Peter Jackson hasn't been able to make the kind of same sense of a movie as Brain Dead, or as you have described it, a personality transplant, the fact that he's taken the editor of Brain Dead editing Lord of the Rings, that the co-writers of Brain Dead have produced Lord of the Rings movies. One of the screenplay writers went on to co-write The Two Towers. I just quick Wikipedia that too.
It is his partner. Yeah.
So it's fantastic to see that if the movie has a lot of gravity to it, if you still enjoy the process with people you've met in childhood or your formative years, young adulthood, to then continue to, you're still playing with them, but with multi-million dollar budgets and Oscars on the line. But there's still, I'd like to think, a sense of play as to why people have the same collaborators. You have fun. It's make-believe with the same team of people.
No, totally. I also think we, lest we forget Mortal Engines.
Yes. Yes, I saw the last showing of that because I was just like, I gotta see what this fucking thing is. I invited my Arden co-creator Sarah Golub. We went and watched The Mortal Engines, and I think it was us and one other person in the theater. And when Shrike appeared, I was like, Shrike me, Shrike. Daddy. Shrike. That movie is fucking bonkers.
It's great. It's great.
But especially, it came out in 2018, especially at that point in time, it just felt like there were so, both blockbusters had gotten so homogenous, and it felt like that movie had escaped from 2007 and traveled forward in time. Yes. And I don't know if it's a good movie so much as it's just the movie I needed to see at that moment, but it does have Shrike in it, and no movie with Shrike can be all bad.
I didn't have the pleasure of seeing it on the big screen. I watched it, I believe, early days of the pandemic is when I watched it. I only bring this up, Jill, because to your point, I think that, you know, when Peter Jackson produces or gets behind somebody, I think it's really interesting as to what projects he decides to kind of give his full weight behind. And that he just went full tilt on Mortal Engines, God bless him, and was there every day. I mean, I don't want to say shadow directed it, but was a very sort of like steady hand there. The film's directed by one of his Weta people, if I'm not mistaken, one of the people that does special effects or you know, below the line in some capacity with him in the past. It is sort of fascinating when you're in his position of this sort of not just enormous wealth, but just like enormous clout to be able to sort of move the needle in a real way. I think it's kind of fascinating. And that he's now decided to sort of put all of that behind these documentaries. I think this is really interesting.
I must be so tired. 6 Lord of the Rings movies after. Totally see his POV.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when people were like, when Get Back was about to come out, people were like, he's releasing a 5-hour Beatles documentary. Does he know how to cut anything? And it turned out he'd done a lot of editing. And also, that movie needed that length. Like, the scene where they're just like, you need to see the genius happening out of just humdrum reality. The scene where Paul's just like, I'm going to write Get Back in 5 minutes is has been like justly acclaimed, you know, for so many reasons, but it's because it emerges from that monotony. And I'm glad he's making documentaries. I hope he makes another feature. I hope he just,
he's doing another Beatles doc, isn't he? Am I crazy?
Think so.
Get Backer.
Getting back.
I just hope, I hope he finds some, honestly, Peter Jackson does seem like he's kind of motivated by IP that's in certain ways. I hope he finds some book he wants to adapt, some comic he wants to adapt. I hope he just goes whole hog. Or barring that, I hope he somehow taps into the guy who made this and is like, I'm going to make another zombie movie set in rural New Zealand. I'll go see it. I'll go see it right away.
Yeah. And I mean, also, you know, the lack of success monetarily for Mortal Engines, I would still love to see him do something like that again. I would love to see him produce something like that. I would love to see him get behind people and use, I mean, District 9 is a perfect example of, you know, he got behind that. That movie's success in a lot of ways is hinged on, you know, Peter Jackson Presents or whatever the case might be. I have my issues with District 9. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there, but you know, he's just pick random, cool, awesome, small names that you want to turn into something. I don't know. I'm a big proponent of that.
I wonder if his clout has diminished to the point where it's hard to do that within the system, unless you're doing like the $5 million or less budget where you can get a deal with a Jason Blum or somebody who specifically produces movies like that. But
and Andy got burned on Mortal Engines.
Yeah. Listen, PJ, make Mortal Engines too. You know the world is crying out for it.
It's a series, isn't it? It's a series of books.
There's a whole bunch of books. And the thing about Mortal Engines is it's kind of as like, people are like, did they put all 3 books in this? No, it's a serious adaptation of the first book. All that shit happens in the first book.
Yeah, there are 3 of them. It cost $150 million and it made $83 million. So I don't think we're getting any more Mortal Engines.
No. Listen, Broadway musical. That's the only way to do it.
Maybe Mortal Engines will be the next Dune, and in 30 years' time.
Oh, that's cool. Scrappy, I like that.
Yeah, a scrappy young French Canadian will be able to helm the definitive Mortal Engines adaptation.
Incredible. I like where your head's at, Jill. That sounds fantastic. I mean, I do think, though, in terms of Braindead and in terms of like what it launched him into, I think that Heavenly Creatures, which if our listeners haven't seen it, go and watch it. Jill, have you seen Heavenly Creatures?
I need to. My girl Melanie Linsky's in it, so I know it's on the list.
It's a tremendous movie. Her and Kate Winslet are absolutely unbelievable in it. It's a really, I think it's a really beautiful movie. Emily, I feel like you haven't seen it in a while. I haven't seen it in a while. But...
Haven't seen it in probably 10 years, but I've seen it 3 or 4 times. I think it's stunning. I love that movie. It might be my favorite of his. It's a toss up between that and Fellowship. So
yeah. I would agree. As much fun as I have with the Frighteners, and I love the Frighteners, Heavenly Creatures shows. I mean, Heavenly Creatures is the moment when I think he becomes legitimate as a filmmaker. These horror films feel like, you know, fun little what have yous, but I think, and I don't mean to be dismissive of Braindead because I loved it, but you know, sort of getting at.
Peter Jackson regularly collaborates with a lot of women, particularly Fran Walsh, but he also once Philippa Boyens joins them on the movies, the Lord of the Rings movies, those extremely popular.
They're very popular.
You know, he works with her a lot again. And what was unique about Heavenly Creatures is it really felt like he gave himself over to Fran Walsh's like idea, like portrayal of adolescence. Obviously, he's also a credited co-writer. I'm sure he had a lot of say, but like there's so much about that movie that's specific to the teenage girl experience that like I know she was putting in there, and I think he's really good at collaboration. And Peter, come back to us. Mortal Engines 2. Let's do it.
I, you know, the thing about Heavenly Creatures, which I actually think you can see, there's a lot of Yellow Jackets in there too, I feel like. In terms of you have no idea what I'm talking about, right? The one day you spent in the
writer's room. Melanie Linsky is in both, so that is true.
I'm not trying to draw too many correlations between that one thing, but I do wonder, first of all, whether or not she's gravitated towards that experience. I think that what the young girls, the teenage girls, are going through in Yellow Jackets has some similarities. I think the relationships, anyway.
I think there is a thing within horror about teenage girls, which includes Yellow Jackets, and I'd say Heavenly Creatures, that is very much about the ways that teenage girl friendships can turn into all consuming black holes that end up, leading to some really dark places. I think most of the femme people in my life have that relationship from when they were 16, 17 with another woman or femme person. And like, that is so often like a thing you get kind of fixate on, that you kind of gravitate toward. Now, not all of us cannibalized each other, but enough of us did.
Metaphorically speaking, of course.
Of course. I'll be very interested to hear what you think of it, Jill, if and when you watch it, because I do think that it's a real fulcrum point for Peter Jackson's career. And I think that I'll say this. I do think that technically, in terms of what he accomplishes and his Below the Line accomplish with the effects in Braindead, unquestionably, you're seeing them in. Just to give you a little bit of context, Jill, essentially, Kate Winslet and Melanie Linsky visualize this fantasy world, essentially. And the fantasy world is these kind of claymation monster type things. So you can definitely see the connection between those things. It is really interesting. I think it's a phenomenal film. And then Frighteners is sort of the first time that he starts to actually dip his toe into computer generated effects, and with some of the ghost effects and this amazing kind of black cloak that the kind of with the Sith scythe that the character, the killer in that, it's all really cool shit. Love
Frighteners. Frighteners is fun.
Have you seen Frighteners, Joe?
No, I'm straight into the Lord of the Rings generation, so I had to go backwards for Braindead.
Yeah, no, I would Heavenly Creatures and Frighteners, I would say, definitely worth going back for. I think you'd really enjoy them, and I think you'll see a lot of corollaries to his earlier work, especially with Brain Dead. But let's rate this film, shall we? So basically on this podcast, Joe, we rate the film from 0 to 99. 0 being the worst, 99 obviously being the highest, 50 being generally speaking, whether or not you would recommend this film. I didn't see this film in 92. As I mentioned, this was the first time I saw it. And before this podcast, I was at an 87. I think I'm sticking at 87. I loved this movie. I thought it was great. We'll definitely go back and watch this again. Try to find a 4K Blu-ray of this movie, I believe, is somewhere out in the world. So that's something. Emily just made a face.
I don't know if I want to see this in 4K. I'm sorry. had a great time. Don't want to see it in 4K.
What about intestines in 4K? Sounds gross to you.
Really? So we're you poking pustules again.
Yeah.
What about you, Emily? Where are you on this?
I'm gonna do queerphobia scale first.
Yes,
I feel like this movie's like a 2. Like there's it's very much like, again, like I said, it's about like repression. It's about the things that we're too scared to admit. So there is like a fun queer reading of this film, which I was not expecting.
Yeah.
If I really wanted to like elaborate on it, I probably could. I could write an article, but I don't have to do that anymore.
You could write a Substack.
I should write a Substack. I should just start a Substack as queer readings of weird horror movies. I could do it.
Do it.
So rating. I came in 72. I'm going to go up to a 74 just because I like you so much.
Oh,
you're both great.
Thanks. Jill, where are you? 0 to 99.
Oh, man. That's great to hear that it's passing grades on Brain Dead. I feel like it's definitely high 80s for me, like at least like 85 to 88. Like it's definitely like ramshackle, but the intelligence to it, the wit to it, the practical effects, the Foley artistry. There's so much great gurgling. I mean, that would have been so fun. Mouthwash for the greater good of horror. I find that something that's been kicking around my mind. We've asked the question about why Brain Dead isn't as revered, and I think also it's because whenever humor intersects with art, there's this idea that it's like slapstick pantomime, that it's inherently not as quote unquote good because it is fun or funny. And that really grinds my gears. Humor can be done really very intelligently, as we see throughout this movie. I think to Barbarian, the fellow mommy dearest terrorizing horror, and how humor is an undercurrent in that. And yet humor was also the basis of skepticism. A24 turned down Barbarian, not willing to get with those like shifts in not only tone, but time. And I find that it heightens a work. It heightens what you're able to do. Sometimes exaggerating something allows you to see the true horror of what's at the surface, which is this overbearing parent-child abusive codependent relationship that we see our dear boy Lionel finally break free of as he casts away the mystical symbol he didn't need all along. It was all about his confidence. And I'm so proud of Lionel.
He did need to go back into the uterus first to defeat.
This is true.
That's a step we all have to take. Yeah.
Yep. Born again.
You talking about Barbarian made me realize that there are these like two kinds of horror about mothers, and one is like the usually made by men. I think that women have a very different relationship to stories about motherhood for obvious reasons. There is this kind of movie, which is I am terrified of my mother and that she will shove me back in her womb, but also I'm kind of interested in that I had all my needs met there. And then Barbarian is very much like I have had a child with my partner and she got pregnant and her body went berserk and I find that terrifying. And like those two are always kind of in tension. I love that. I love when men make movies about pregnancy, and I sound like I'm joking.
They understand,
but I'm not.
It. They really understand.
They do. No, what I love about men making movies about pregnancy and about motherhood is that they're always slightly terrified of it. And like, I think that's
absolutely.
That's fun. Yeah.
So next week on this podcast, we are covering a film, Jill, that I don't know if you've seen. It's called School Ties. It's we've got Michael Hobbs coming on to talk about boarding school anti-Semitism with Brendan Fraser and baby versions of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Every male actor of that generation said. Yeah.
Have you seen School Ties, Joe?
No, but the fact that Brendan Fraser is in that, it doesn't surprise me. He's popped up everywhere, like Kids in the Hall's Brain Candy, right, in the 90s. Sure. I feel like everyone could sort of go back through their film oeuvre and be like, oh yeah, Brendan Fraser was there. He's just like that constant cool guy that's in your class that you don't really talk to, but has a mystique.
He definitely, I mean, had a big 92. Encino Man was his kind of coming out movie in a lot of ways, kind of made him a star. And then he had this film and obviously, you know, the Mummy movies in the late 90s. And I mean, listen, big Brendan Fraser fan. Katty, the previous co-host of this podcast, said that Brendan Fraser was going to win an Oscar back in 2018. And he was right. Brendan Fraser won an Oscar last year. So
the Brendan Fraser stock has never been higher. I'm someone who saw Monkey Bone in theaters. So my love to Brendan Fraser through thick and thin, through George of the Jungle to the Mummy Ride.
Earlier said that you aren't a fan of Bones, and yet you saw Monkey Bone.
Yeah, you saw Monkey Bone.
A Monkey Bone or Funny Bone. I can make exceptions for those two. It's just like a strict bone.
I understand.
Like, we can develop this more. Let's discuss.
When it's not a funny bone, it just doesn't work for you. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, if I was Siskel and Ebert when Monkey Bone came out, I would have said, Monkey Bone, where's the funny bone? Oh,
seriously. That movie sucks. That movie's really
rough. I can't believe.
But Brendan Fraser, yeah, I mean, did you see The Whale?
I have avoided it as I avoid things that are saturated in discourse. I want to go through it on my own. And there's some rightful criticisms of the Whale, but it's kind of like when everyone... This happened with the movie Inception when it came out. Everyone told me it was the greatest movie ever, but also all my friends were 18. So anything loud and highly well produced is the greatest movie ever at that age. And then I was like, it was decent, but you sold me on like a T-Rex high-fiving me, you know? Like, and I didn't get that quite out of this experience. So with The Whale, I don't have an interest in The Whale so much as it is the Fraser Renaissance. I am all about that.
Yeah, I am too. Not a fan of The Whale. Emily, you saw The Whale? Didn't see The Whale?
It's like the worst movie I saw last year.
Yeah,
like, it's a bad movie. We're buried far enough in the podcast so I can say this because my mom will never hear this.
Yeah.
She called me up and was like, it's so powerful. It's such a good movie. And I was like, are we really, like, I really issued from your loins.
Like, nothing about Fat Phobia is groundbreaking. That's not cinema. Yeah.
She was very overwhelmed by the, like, it's about, you know, I guess you could argue it's about the triumph of, like, one, like, life and all these things and, like, what's valuable in life. And Sadie Sink, I think she's given her all, but that's a truly disastrous character to have to play. You can, like, I just feel like, when the writer of the play realized that the title of Moby Dick is Moby Dick or the Whale, and he could write a thing about a Moby Dick scholar who also could be credibly called the Whale, he should have just quit. That's like a premise for like a fucking family circus cartoon.
Well, this has been our episode on Dead Alive / The Whale. Jill, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you. Always good to hear from a fellow Torontonian. And
damn
Emily,
right,
You'll get your fellow South Dakotan. I know it.
It's going to happen for me.
Where can people find you, Jill? Because they should be following you on various social media.
Oh, absolutely. I'm at Jill Krajewski, and feel free to drop in the link in your description. At Jill Krajewski on Twitter, on Blue Sky. My website is myself. Come follow me. I also love to make really silly memes on Instagram. It's my creative outlet. It's my equivalent of George Bush getting into painting all of a sudden. Now I just slap things together in Photoshop for the fun of it.
Listen, people should be following you. If for nothing else, your love of all things Succession, they should be following you on your you're absolutely wonderful and all these things. They should be reading you as well, obviously. They can find you, obviously, as we mentioned up top, in Vulture, in New York Magazine, Spin, Pitchfork, what have you. Thank you so much, Joe. This was an absolute blast.
Thank you. Thank you both. This has been so much fun. As fun as sliding into your own mother.
I mean, we're not going to do better than that. But yes, I believe you.
End of episode. No, end of episode. We're done.
Thank you so much, Joe. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.